This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for joining me on this beautiful morning. I'm Kesia. I wanted to let you guys know what kind of talk this would be. I debated a couple of different introductions in light of April Fool's Day. But I'll spare you those because some of them were a little inappropriate. But just imagine in your mind what I might have told you guys I was going to speak about. But I'm not. So a way-seeking mind talk is a talk given by someone who is not a priest, as far as I know.
It's your first talk.
It's my first talk, and it's about how we came to practice. So it's more of a personal reflection than a Dharma talk, although of course it relates. So I want to talk a little bit about the sutra that we chanted today, the sutra on the heart of realizing wisdom beyond wisdom. This is the sutra that talks about all five streams of body and mind being boundless, and also form not being separate from boundlessness, and boundlessness not being separate from form. And these are kind of concepts that are familiar to people that have studied Buddhism. But what I really like about this sutra is that it talks about the place that realizing these things puts you in. It talks about the impact of these realizations on your way of being in the world. So I wanted to read a couple of lines here. Being free of attainment, those who help all to awaken abide in the realization of wisdom beyond wisdom, and live with an unhindered mind. Without any hindrance, the mind has no fear. So especially that last line, the mind has no fear, relates to a lot of what studying Zen has given me. And I wanted to also read a tiny bit of commentary, because that's always really spoken to me, form and boundlessness and boundlessness and form. So I looked up a little bit of commentary on this to try to understand it better. This sutra affirms that this boundless mind is Buddha, none other than Buddha, a mind that is everywhere and nowhere, a mind that is both timeless and an embrace of this moment, a mind that has realized life as eternal. It belongs to no one and to everyone, and is a bond of vastness that brings all beings into unity. The Heart Sutra is a victory chant that celebrates this boundlessness and the mind's potential to realize wisdom beyond wisdom. It is a paean to fearlessness and affirms that this vast and fearless mind is your mind and my mind. Pretty cool, right? So I come from a Christian background, and I had always felt this strong connection to the transcendental, you know, to God. And so I'd always sensed that there was something bigger than myself, but I'd also always struggled with a lot of existential anxiety that could rise to a kind of dysphoria, just a really intense discontentment with life that never seemed to be abated by anything. And it put me into a position of a lot of anxiety, a lot of depression. And despite my spirituality, it didn't really seem to help. I mean, it might help momentarily, like be a comfort, but I still felt like life wasn't okay. I remember describing life once as feeling to me like a burning building that I had to just get out of. That was my life, like all the time. And when I came to meditation practice, that helped me with depression, with anxiety, just the way that mindfulness does. I studied meditation fairly casually. You know, I would sit and meditate. And it helped me to get distance from what I was feeling and experiencing, but it didn't really end the existential terror that I would feel. It didn't stop the almost hysterical levels of not okayness that would kind of plagued me like all the time. But I came to Jikoji about five months ago, to live. And I started studying more intensively, really digging into Zen a little bit and sitting more often and for longer. And I started to feel that there was just so much more that I could be getting out of this practice. And it was really cool. Like, I was just scratching the surface. And I had an experience during meditation retreat we had here called Sesshin, where I guess I would say I experienced what I would call Buddha nature. It was an experience of dissolving into this bigger reality of oneness, just kind of this greater truth of the world. And in it, everything was okay. And I experienced that viscerally, not intellectually. And the things that I had existential angst about, I really saw that they ultimately weren't that important. And I saw that whatever not okayness I felt, everything and everyone was actually one. And it was really cool. And I kind of thought, like, why don't they tell people about this? You know, like, like when we talk about meditation, like there's this this really cool thing. So the way I've described it to people since then is that, you know, when you start out sitting, you start to detach your conscious, you start to see like your conscious mind as a thing that you can look at. And it's like, oh, cool, well, that's not me. That's my thoughts, you know, my feelings. So I enjoyed that for a while. But what I experienced in that experience in Sesshin and since then is this slow revelation that there's something on the other side. There's something behind the curtain. And it's not just this kind of abstract looking. It's like the mirror turned around as I started to sit more. And I felt that, well, if I'm not these things, if these things, these five skandhas of everything that we see and experience are not me, they're not real, there's actually something that is. Like there's something that I started to call like Buddha nature. And that's not a perfect term, but so that's been something that has given me an anchor in my life and a kind of grounding. And it's something I've never really been able to experience before. There's this this verse in the Bible, in the Psalms, I think. When my heart is weak within me, lead me to the rock that is higher than I. And that's kind of sums up how I feel about what Zen has given me and what these experiences have given me. And, you know, depression is something I don't want to say struggle with. It's something I've experienced, deep, deep depression often, periods of it throughout my life. And I probably will again, because I have a condition, like I have a genetic predisposition to it. And I don't think that studying Zen is a magic bullet that can free you from any kind of mental illness or any kind of, because I don't believe that's the nature of these things, that they're just in the mind. But I still feel a sense of safety that I've never had before, that whatever I'm feeling, whatever anxiety I'm feeling, whatever discontentedness with my life, that I have to get out of here feeling, there's like a refuge that is like a true sense of fearlessness, a place of fearlessness. I was having a really difficult time in my life a couple years ago, And I started practicing a lot of yoga. And that kind of introduced me to Eastern spirituality a little bit. And I remember laying on my back at the end of class, the lights all dim. If you guys have ever done yoga, that really nice period where you've done all the hard work in the yoga class and they just let you like lay there and you're like, oh, thank God it's over. If you're anything like me. And my teacher would say different kind of spiritual things at the end of class. And she said, there is a light in the heart that dims all sorrows. And that has stuck with me. When my little nephew was born, I was there for that. And I held him and I wanted to say something like welcome, you know, like some kind of welcome to the world thing. Like in Sleeping Beauty, the story, like these three fairies come to Aurora and they like give her like different kind of blessings. It was a similar feeling to that. Like I wanted to, you know, give him some kind of like, okay, introductory statement. What do you need to know? Like you're here now. And I said, there is a light in the heart that dims all sorrows. And just like, I feel like if people can know that, that's something they can always turn to and find. It's this inherent dignity and this inherent strength that no one can take away from you. So to me, all these things are related. And the last thing I want to say is that, you know, it says in this sutra, all five skandhas are empty. And we talk about emptiness in Zen. And I heard a couple definitions of emptiness that I really liked a lot and preferred to kind of the English connotation of the word emptiness. And I think one of them was emptiness is not an absence. It's a space of complete openness and complete possibility. And it contains everything. So when we talk about, you know, what we see, what we are, the five skandhas being empty, or boundlessness being form and form being boundlessness, I think about that space. It's the space that we truly inhabit and that everything inhabits, and that it's not empty. It's like that curtain that I felt in meditation, that there's consciousness looking at our thinking mind, the world. But if you flip it around, that emptiness that you're looking from is not emptiness. And the world is not emptiness. Yeah, I think that's about it for my talk.
Well, the traditional first question is, how do you feel right now?
Is that really the traditional first question?
Yeah.
That's a very, like, I would not expect.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it?
How do you, it's almost like a psychologist chair question. How do you feel right now? I don't remember that being asked in other Wayseeking Mind talks.
No.
I think you're messing with, is this an April Fool's joke?
No.
The traditional first question is, what did you have for breakfast? It's the actual.
What did you have for breakfast?
I had an energy bar. What did we all have for breakfast? That'll kill some time, right? Let's go one by one. How do I feel right now? I mean, I feel a little vulnerable. I think that's normal, you know? I mean, who cares about what's normal? But I feel grounded in who I am, which is always an awesome, best feeling that you can bring into any day, any situation. Is that, oh yeah, like I'm actually with it, with who I am right now. I'm not just operating out of my, you know, daily kind of life programming, going through the day stuff. So, is Does anyone want to share how they feel?
Kisia, could you say something a little bit more about your background, your work, and where you grew up, and just kind of personal?
But why does anyone care about that? I will, but I didn't think that was particularly... Yeah. Okay. I grew up in Washington State in the San Juan Islands, very beautiful place. I had a very tempestuous young life. I left home very, very early. It's kind of grew up too fast. I left home when I was 13. And I've been working through a lot of the impact that my life has had on me. Family has a lot of colorful. My dad's an alcoholic. There's a lot of mental illness and drug abuse in my family. So those things have definitely shaped. Working class, poor family. That's definitely shaped who I am and the experiences I've had. I guess that feels more relevant in the sense of my background than where I work I work at a animal welfare nonprofit. I support people trying to go vegan. Try it. Try it. Yeah, if you take one thing from this talk, it'll change your life. That's all I can think of, I guess, for my background. Todd?
I remember the first day that I met you, and I was... very impressed by your hold on the language, which you've expressed here today quite eloquently, I think.
Thank you.
You don't have notes in front of you. You speak beautifully. And this is an area that I've always admired in other people. I've struggled with it myself. So what's come to my mind is maybe how you might be able to talk about how what you put together today and how maybe that might have, how that helps you to label. I see language as a form of labeling, a way of making it what kind of some kind of semblance of order that frees you from it, from the depression, from the things are you can't understand your feelings, etc. How does it? You could just help me understand how you do that.
Can I rephrase your question just to make sure I understand what you're saying? Are you asking how I kind of think about things in words and conceptualize them in order to kind of let these very ephemeral concepts and ideas and experiences become something that I can really say, like even internally, like that I, hold to? Is that, how does putting things into language help me to use them? Is that kind of what you're saying?
For you, liberate you. Does it, I don't want to put words in your mouth, so does it liberate you? Does it free you? Does it, doing what you just did, does this, how does it help you?
I think when I actually have the experience, it's not so much about the words, not so much putting it into words to understand it, but when I speak from my heart, it helps me to, it does something with those. So it's more about what's going on beyond using words. There's in the chakra system, in Hinduism, which my friend Leela knows well, there's a chakra called the throat chakra, and it has to do with speaking, like with expression and speaking your truth. And when like what's in my heart comes out in that way, I feel like it's a very magical and spiritual experience for me, because I feel like I'm fully expressing myself in the world, like as a being, like I'm fulfilling my purpose. That's a very strong part of my sense of my purpose, is speaking the truth. Sometimes that comes out in a very challenging, I don't want to say confrontational, but sometimes that comes out like a sword, kind of. But sometimes it comes out as love. And when I can speak lovingly and affirmingly to people about something that's very deep and that I feel is very true and real, and try to share that with them, I feel most like myself. Anyone know any good jokes?
I know the best knock-knock joke ever.
Oh, can you tell it, please?
You start.
Knock-knock.
Who's there?
I don't know. Wait, did I screw... Oh, I screwed that one up. You tripped me. I forgot to think about what knock-knock jokes are. So, a mushroom walks into a bar, and the bartender says, "We don't serve your kind here." And he says, "Why not? I'm a fun guy."
I can tell you, my father-in-law's was a pastor. His favorite joke was, a new pastor comes to a church and gives a sermon, and everybody enjoys it, and everybody's happy. And at the end of the, as they walk out, they shake his hand. And so the next week, he gives the exact same sermon, but not quite as enthusiastic response. And third week, he does the exact same sermon again. This time, it's not, people are a little... But anyway, somebody says, so, you're giving the same sermon. He said, yeah, well, when you get this one done, I'll go to the next one.
That is pretty funny.
I think, to me, it's partly that, in a way, all Dharma talks are the same, in the sense that we're trying to point to something. And so if there's a bit of repetitiveness, it's okay. Not that yours was repetitive.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's really only, this is kind of the same thing you're saying, which is ironic considering what your point was. But I think there's only one answer to every question, and that's love. So even if it can get, I think if we were all really being honest and direct all the time, conversations would be a little bit boring, because it would all just come back to that same ultimate reality over and over. Not that that's boring, but when we really like complexify worldviews a lot, I think it's kind of like a big joke to me that like really it's everything is love, but it's kind of funny that we pretend that it's anything else. It's like when someone's like, oh, it's not, or they don't live their life like that's the most important thing, I'm like, are you playing a prank on me? So I think ultimately like everyone will just realize that. I think like the end of the cosmology that I subscribe to is that the end of the universe is when like the last person is like, yeah. Yeah, like, and they take like the person before them's hand that's like extended. And it's like, come on, come on, it's okay, come on. And finally, they're like, the last holdout's like, okay. Like, that's my apocalyptic vision. Yeah.
I'll ask a question related to that, which is, I think it's relevant for those of us sort of in the middle of our lives, right? Because often in practices like this, you do see there's a generational difference and the outlook. So one thing I do think about quite a bit is skillful means when it comes to love. Because indeed, love is the final answer, and we still have to figure out how to love, which is no piece of cake. And so I am curious, how skillful means, how it plays into your practice.
Ooh, by skillful means, do you mean how to show, how to express that in a kind of literal day-to-day way, skillfully?
Both for love and in general, just how to be an adult in this, how to show up fully in this part of our lives.
It's a great question, and it's one I don't have an immediate, it's a very deep question. Have an immediate answer for that. I think while I formulate or try to formulate an answer, I'd be curious to know if anyone else has a perspective on this that comes to mind for them.
Well, I've had the experience of, like, I'm extremely skills-focused, as Kisia and some of you here know, and I'm obsessed with getting the skills I need to figure out how to do something right, but I do experience, like, if I just go to a hard place, as Kisia mentioned, there is an intelligence there that directs you, and it is higher, and it actually leads me to whatever experience I need to become skilled. But it's not like an effort feeling. It just, like, I end up being in a place with a conversation where somebody gives me information. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. And then I'm put in a position where I need to use that information. But I didn't plan any of it. And so I don't think we need to plan it out like what we imagine. So yeah, that's one thing.
I think what I hear is that there's an intuition.
It uses cognition, but cognition does not lead it. That's how I would phrase. Cognition is an apparatus that is used secondarily.
I guess I don't totally know what unskillful means of love would be. I don't know if it's like a boundaries thing kind of that you're talking about, or and I think, like, when I say love, I don't mean like enabling or kind of just doing everything that, I mean, I do think it's intuitive. I think that when you're grounded in yourself, like your highest self, you know what to do. And I'm certainly not always in that place, but when I am, it's like, and I believe everybody, you know, everybody has this Buddha nature, I guess. And, you know, we make unskillful mistakes, but I feel like there's a certain courageousness that you have to approach loving people with. Like, it's very messy, you know, sometimes. And I'm not a perfect being of I'm sure as many of you know, I'm not in that loving state all the time, but I never feel regretful of any genuine love that I show, because there's nothing to be afraid of. There's this saying, everything in life is a choice between love and fear. And I very strongly believe that.
I'm wondering about the work you're doing in the world. So you're doing work that is, in a sense, geared to, or designed to change people's behavior. And I'm wondering about how you reconcile something that's very active in terms of changing behavior or changing the way the world is versus being at peace and being simple and kind of going deeper into one's Buddha nature, or as you're calling it.
I think that ultimately they're connected. I think that a desire to make the world a better place comes from the same ultimate source. I think I see what you're saying about there can be a sense of malcontentedness that can drive actions that are intended to change things. But I think that suffering, like wanting to, I think it's natural when you're in your kind of highest self to want to move towards ending suffering, like freeing all beings, like ending suffering. And it doesn't have to be in a anxious kind of, I have to save the world kind of way. For me, it's just a very natural, and it used to be this like sense of anxiety of like, oh, I want to like, you know, make these things better. But it's more like there's something I feel is right and kind of naturally flows that I will do what I think is right. I don't know if that answers your question, but I don't feel in this case, I don't feel a confliction between practice and working towards a world that better reflects compassion and just love, you know, for love for all beings and love for our environment.
And if that work, if it felt like in your work you were being pulled further away from a sense of peacefulness, then what?
Well, I think what I would say about that is I was talking to someone once and he said, it's easy to be with someone when things are good, but like what happens when the shit hits the fan? And I really feel like, yeah, like whatever life philosophy or modality you have, it has to be ready for the shit to hit the fan in life, because it will. Like there's no way to get through without your peacefulness has to be from the inside. So I don't feel like I need to try to seek out peacefulness externally. I mean, of course, like we want to be healthy emotionally. So if something was really toxic for us, then, you know, maybe it's skillful to take a step back and focus on practice just because it might help us in that time in our life. Like it might be good to do that because it would give us a grounding. But yeah, life isn't peaceful. And I don't say that in a like cynical, like life is suffering way, but just it's like no one gets out of here alive. You know? So, I don't know if that's any help, but that's fine. Oh, I have a story. I actually used to work at a church, and I worked with this woman who I really respected. And she had two daughters, and her husband had left her, and she was a single mom and very tough life. And she said to me, sometimes I feel like life is just one big game of chicken. And it's like, and she leaned in with her eyes sparkling and said, don't flinch.
So, don't what?
Don't flinch. like that's the game, so. Thank you.
So I noticed in your talk you said you find comfort in emptiness. And I thought, that's new.
Well, you heard my description of emptiness not being emptiness, right? Well, yeah. Or did you tune out at that point?
Tell me about your journey with emptiness.
Well, I always kind of had an issue with Buddhism in that the idea of like no self and of emptiness really didn't feel right to me as I understood it and as many people understand Buddhism. I think, unfortunately, it's like those words have an implication in our culture that is like nothingness has an implication of, it's almost like trying to comprehend like what is space. I don't know, like the infinity of space. It's just like a weird, difficult. And I always felt that there was something, like that there was something. I could feel it. I could feel something bigger than myself, like always. And when I heard emptiness defined as something else than like an absence that is not an absence, like that's like form and boundlessness, and I don't fully understand this, but those words have really embedded themselves. Form is boundlessness and boundlessness is form. Like everything here is that nothingness, and also that nothingness, quote unquote nothingness, is everything here. And that just really made sense to me. And it let me dwell in the fact that I fully believe that there is a reality of love that is true and not false. Like the Prajnaparamita, gate, 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 paragate, parasamgate. When I learned that that means gone, gone, all the way to the other shore, like gone away, like, it's like, but a way to where? It's like, oh, that really resonated with me. Like this, like kind of beyond words. This idea that there is a reality beyond words, and this is all a finger kind of pointing at it, and talking about emptiness, talking about, you know, nothingness, or that idea of all these things, you know, gone, gone, gone. And that's the mantra that frees us. Like reframing that from being like a, well, nothing is real, so don't worry about it, kind of Buddhism, which I think is how sometimes people think of what Buddhism is about, to, yeah. I don't know, is that helpful? Okay, thank you, Joe. There's just kind of the commentary that I read called this mantra like a victory chant. And when I hear gate, gate, paragate, like gone, gone, all the way to the other shore, gone, I read that in my mind in like a sing-song, victorious kind of way. Like there's just a kind of rebellious, joyful insouciance to it. Like
It ends with Bodhi.
Yeah, yeah.
Which means awake, and swaha means kind of like hooray.
Or yeah, so I didn't know that. I didn't know that swaha meant hooray, but that's exactly the way, that's exactly the way that it feels for me in a way that I can't totally, it's just like, oh, that's cool. I remember the first time I heard the chant, beings are numberless, I vow to save them. And I was like, that's so badass, like to say, like, I was like, wow, that is a, That is a high goal. Save numberless beings. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. I'm just like, yeah, like, let's go. So I say that to myself every day, like the whole thing. But it feels sometimes when I don't really feel in my best self, I feel kind of guilty saying that. Like when I'm kind of being a bad child. I'm like, beings are numberless. I vow to save them. And I feel guilty because I'm like...
I have one real question that I... Because of what you're talking about so much about words, and I struggle with this because I find the practice of actually sitting seems more at the core, even though I learn from Dharma talks and people like yourself. The core of it for me is physical, really, in many ways. And Cliff years ago talked about this ongoing commentary. So someone like yourself and me, and everybody, I think, to these words just continually like some kind of ticker tape. And yet there are times that it somehow kind of like where poetry kind of helps me, or water kind of settles. And even though that ticker tape is kind of goes to the background. And so anyway, I'm just kind of curious what your take is on Dharma talks and sutras in context to what I see or feel is the essence of a sesshin in many ways is the sitting.
Thank you for your question. It's very interesting. I would say it's all about connection. And this just came to me when you were speaking, like what's important about me reading this sutra, or us having this conversation, or me having Dokusan, or me interacting with you on the street, like a real, real interaction. You know those interactions you have with people where it's like, this is real. It's not about the words, it's about the experience of connectedness, and words connect us. What I'm trying to tell you, why I love gate, gate, paragate, parasamgate, I'm not like trying to explain something intellectually to you. There's a dialectic that's happening where I'm speaking to you and you're listening, and you're speaking to me and I'm listening. Mm-hmm. And there's a flow. There's an exchange going on. And you can do that without words, but as humans, we love to play with all kinds of ways of communicating, which are ways of connecting. And I think like with the Dharma as its own abstract like being, it's through its words, it's communicating to us. I remember touching this tree in the forest and feeling like I wanted to give it like love, like it was so beautiful. I just wanted to touch it and like touch it like warmly and lovingly. And I realized that I could approach that interaction one of two ways. I could approach it like I was touching it, or like we were touching each other and opening this receptivity to I can receive at the same time that I give. Like I can touch it with the expectation, not that something will flow out, but that it could flow back. That was just really cool to me.
There's a turning here, though, to the wall. And all that this expression is, this utterance is in here, is a different experience or possibility. I think that's maybe... How does this work for you?
I know what you're saying. Like it seems like two very different, sitting facing a wall versus reading a sutra feels like a different experience to you. Well, I think it is different, you know?
Well, in small ways and big ways, they're the same and they're different. So I can't, but... I'm just curious because you're, and with something else takes the place of the words.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I'm wondering how that.
Yeah. It's interesting. Like, it's not like I'm meditating on concepts and sutras when I'm sitting zazen. So you're right. It does feel like two kind of different. I don't know. For me, the words, studying the Dharma helps me to. Understand more of what's happening in Zazen, maybe, or it helps me live my life. I mean, they both help me live my life, Zazen and the Dharma, but maybe in slightly complementary, like Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, like the three jewels. They all help us manifest and be wise. They help us to, yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Beings are numberless. No? Beings are numberless.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.